Welcome to Aficionado, the official podcast of ManhattanReefs.com, the largest reef website in New York, with your host, Jonathan Robbins.
Welcome back to episode 7 of Aficionado. Here I am, your host, Jonathan Robbins. This is going to be a pretty cool episode. I had gotten this actually as a suggestion from another member of Manhattan Reefs to do a segment talking a bit about sumps, refugiums, and, you know, what the uses are, what the benefits are, do you really need it, just, you know, the whole rundown on it. So I thought that was a great idea. I think there's a lot of sort of, not quite misunderstanding on it, but there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of things that people seem to say are requirements that there's really aren't requirements. You know, you can run a tank with a sump, you can run a tank without a sump, you can run a tank with a refugium, you can run it without a refugium. There's a million different kinds of refugiums you could run. So we're just going to, you know, take a quick look at that all, give it a brief little rundown, and talk about the upsides and downsides of all of it as far as my opinion. Now remember, a lot of this, I'm not a marine biologist. I don't pretend to be a marine biologist. I'm just a hobbyist. So anything I'm going to tell you here is basically based on my opinions, my experience in the hobby. I'm not going to pretend that I can give you a real solid answer as to, you know, which absorbs nutrients faster, Kato or Calerpa or anything like that. I don't know. But I can tell you what I've done and what's worked for me and my sort of take on it. And that's the goal of this podcast. So, without any further ado, let's begin. I guess the best place to start with this discussion is, what is a sump or a refugium? Is it, you know, and what are the differences between the two? So primarily, a sump is just a holding area. It's a secondary tank that normally is underneath your tank, but, you know, you could really put it wherever you want. You want to put it at the same level, like in a different room, you could do that. For a refugium, maybe you could put it above it so it would gravity feed down. But historically, generally, it's, you know, the tank you put in the stand below your main tank. Now, it doesn't do too much unless you can figure out a way to get water into that tank below your stand, and there's really two options for doing this. One is what's called an overflow box, which is effectively just a siphon tube and a little surface skimmer that will maintain sort of continuous siphon and draw water down into your sump, where it's then returned to your tank through an over-the-back return with a pipe that sort of hangs over the back of your tank and blows the water from your sump back up into your tank. The other way you can do it, and this is the more common way, at least in the reef-keeping hobby, is with what's called a reef-ready or a drilled tank. And what they're doing there is they're just putting some holes in the bottom of the tank, and they're putting a weir, or a plastic block, over it so that the water levels will be different. And what happens there is it actually makes a drain in your tank, and the return comes up through the tank. It looks a lot neater and cleaner, and it's a lot more reliable than an overflow box. So those are really the two ways you can get the water down to the sump. Between the two, I have to say, if your tank isn't drilled, I would suggest just forgetting about the overflow box and not running a sump at all. Overflow boxes are notoriously prone to failure. And when they fail, what happens is, all right, quickly, there's two things in this hobby, right? Things can either fail to off, which means they just sort of stop working, or they can fail and you basically are going to have a, for lack of a better word, a breach of containment. Meaning, it's going to fail, and in this device failing, you will put water out of your tank. So, most devices, when they fail, if they fail to off, it's a simple thing, right? The device just shuts down. Maybe it's not good for your tank, probably not, but is not going to be catastrophic. Things that fail and lead to a breach of containment are catastrophic. So, with a hang-on overflow box, a lot of times what will happen is lots of little bubbles, air bubbles, will eventually get stuck in the top of the U in the siphon tube. It happens, right? Little bubbles get in there, and they sort of get stuck up there because it's the highest point they can get to. Eventually, enough of these bubbles will accumulate, and it will break the siphon. Now, the problem is, your return pump, which is down in your sump, doesn't know you've broken the siphon. So all that happens, it keeps pumping all your sump, all the water, back up into the tank, and it just overflows your tank all over the place. That's a bad kind of failure. I'm not a fan of that kind of failure. So I generally say avoid overflow boxes like the plague. Alright. That's enough of my railing on overflow boxes. Let's get into what these things actually are. So, fundamentally, a sump and a refugium are spaces outside of your main tank, of your display tank, where you will either house extra equipment, or, in the case of a refugium, livestock that otherwise would probably not fare very well in your main tank, either due to predation, or the flow, or whatever it is. You know, it's stuff that you really want to shelter and provide a refuge to, hence the name, where these various organisms can multiply. That's part of it. The other part is, it's not just organisms, you're also going to be growing algae, macroalgae generally, in your refugium. And that's stuff that your fish generally would like to eat, generally. This stuff grows really fast, and it can suck up a lot of nutrients. And the idea is that it will outcompete the microalgae, the nuisance algae, that you have growing in your main tank, and the growth of the macroalgae in the sump will actually help strip the nutrients from the water and retard the growth of the micro or the nuisance algae that's in your display. Now, in theory, that's great. In reality, I think what most people do with a fuge is you have a 100-gallon tank, and you portion off a 5-gallon part of your sump as a fuge. I don't think that's enough. I think if you really want to be growing algae, the most success I've ever had is when I basically had set up like a 40 breeder as a separate fuge underneath a 150-gallon tank with another, I guess it was a 30-gallon sump. And it worked. It worked great. I mean, my cato grew like crazy, and I found that to be the most successful. I think a lot of these smaller fuges that you see where people talk about pod production, where that's sort of this added benefit. People say if you're going to keep difficult to keep fish, and the ones that immediately pop to mind, right, are mandarins, potter's angels, things like that. You want to be able to grow a large supply of copepods, amphipods, mysis, shrimp, everything that's going to be growing down in your fuge. And the idea is that those critters will migrate out of the fuge in a sort of, you know, a steady trickle as they migrate out into the main tank, and will provide a sort of a secondary food source for your fish. Now, I got to tell you, I really don't think that works very well. I just don't. Most of the copepods and amphipods that you see in your fuge, actually, you know, they're not free swimming. It's not like they get swept away with the current that often. And they just don't. I mean, it's not like they're that weak. I've seen mysis shrimp hanging onto the edge of my vortex sometimes. I mean, that's serious flow. So if they can sit there and walk around on the edge of the vortex, it's not like your return pump or the flow through your sump is really going to be sweeping huge amounts of these guys out into the water stream. There's other stuff that might be getting out, rotifers, things like that. Maybe, I don't know, I doubt it. I wouldn't bank on this thing, especially for the way most people have these set up as, you know, 10% or less of their tank volume. I wouldn't bank on this thing generating enough of a food source to be able to sustain very difficult or very finicky fish. So if that's your goal, I would approach it with a little bit of caution. On the other hand, it certainly provides more biodiversity to the tank. Now, whether that biodiversity winds up as food for your fish, or whether it, you know, helps consume detritus that makes its way down there, or, you know, polishes the water, whatever it does, it can have lots of other beneficial effects on your tank other than just pod production, which, again, I don't think they're that great for. Now, the thing with a fuge also, and this is what you got to remember, is the stuff that lives in there, you generally want a slower flow, a slower amount of water turnover through your fuge than you do through your sump, right? My attitude is sort of like this. Say my skimmer, I have a 93-gallon tank and about, 30 gallons in the sump. So say my skimmer can suck 400 gallons of water an hour, right? That means it can pull in 400 gallons of untreated water, expose it to air, and expel 400 gallons of skimmed water per hour. Well, to be most efficient, I want to make sure my skimmer is able to get 450 gallons, or whatever the number is, per hour of clean water down into it so it can skim it. So, for example, if my skimmer is pulling 400 gallons an hour, but my return pump is only pushing 200 gallons an hour, I'm just skimming the same water over and over again, right? My skimmer is effectively going to be running at half its capacity because you're not giving it enough dirty water. On the other hand, the refugium, you actually want a slower flow through it because a lot of the critters and a lot of the stuff that's going to be living in there will actually benefit from a slower flow. Also, if you're going to run a deep sand bed in your refugium or a remote sand bed, if you put that much flow through, you're just going to blow it all over the place and it's not going to work. Or if you're running mud or anything like that, you want to give it a slower flow. You want to give the algae and all that a little bit more time to absorb the nutrients in the water, I think. And again, this is just my opinion. If you're going to run a refuge and you say you want to blow 1,200 gallons an hour through it, go for it. Knock yourself out. If it works for you, that's doubly cool, and let me know what you did, because I'll give it a try. But in general, they sort of have different requirements, right? The feed you're going to want to have a light on. You generally don't want to have a light near your sump, because you don't want algae and crap growing all in your sump. It just makes your life more difficult to clean. So, though frequently you see them sort of combined together with a sump with a refugium sort of in it, I would be a little cautious about the effectiveness of that. And there's certain ways I think you can do it that would make it more effective than others. So, in full disclosure, I actually have a segment of my sump that is a refugium. But the only way it is fed is from a tee off from the return pump. So the return pump actually tees off and feeds the refugium at a very slow rate. So that refugium, then feeds back into the return box. So I can control both the flow through the sump and separately the flow into the refugium by the way my sump is set up. Most often, that's not the case. And what you'll see is you'll have a sump, and looking at it, it's a rectangle, so looking at it from the lengthwise, horizontally, you're going to have, the section where the drain is, where maybe you're going to have some filter socks and your skimmer. Then most of these sumps will have a refugium section in the middle, and then the return pump will be on the other side of it. Now, I think this is a really bad setup for a sump and fuge. If you already have it and it's working for you, then that's fine. I wouldn't say go change it. But if you're going into it and you're looking to plan and set this thing up, I wouldn't do it that way. I think what happens is you're left with two choices, which is either A, you have to really slow down the flow through your sump, so you sort of starve your skimmer to keep your fuge alive, or you blow so much water through it that your fuge is just going nuts and is going crazy because the stuff that you want to cultivate that actually requires slightly lower flow isn't going to get it. So if you're going to do it, I would sort of be aware of that. Now, a sump itself, I should probably just touch on this quickly, is slightly different than a refugium, right? A sump is really just a secondary tank to hide all of the junk that would otherwise be hanging on the back wall of your tank. Your heaters, your skimmers, reactors, anything like that you can think of that you might want to be putting any equipment, you can generally just run it in the sump. The sump is also a great place to do testing, water changes, all of that, because it means you don't have to, mess around in your main tank, freak your fish out, and make everybody go nuts. And I guess the final benefit of a sump is, there's a saying in the hobby that goes basically, the solution to pollution is dilution. So the more water volume that you can have for the same amount of fish, the safer you're going to be, the more stable your tank will be. So what a sump does, or a refugium in that case too, is it gives you a large fish-free volume of water. So instead of having, say, 10 fish in 90 gallons, you now have 10 fish in 120 gallons, right? It gives you about 30% more space in the tank, more water per fish. And that's just like a free buffer zone that you have. So the extent, the biggest sump you can fit under there will probably give you the most benefit in that respect. I guess here's my take on it. Do you need either one of these, right? And the answer is no, you don't. You really don't. There's tons of tanks out there that are just a tank, right? They're not drilled, they don't have sumps, they don't have fuges, they don't have crazy equipment, It's you have lights, you maybe have a skimmer. If it's small enough, they don't even have a skimmer. They just do water changes, and they have a power head. You can run a tank just fine doing that. You absolutely can. Tons of people have done it. It's not like... On the boards, right? On the websites, there's sort of a... There gets to be this sort of macho or tough guy mentality to it, or there's like a keeping up with the Joneses. It's like an arms race, you know? And somebody gets some equipment or doodad or whatever it is, everybody else has to have it or get the next best thing. For the most part, I feel like this is a fool's errand, right, because these things aren't that appreciably different, yada yada. But in this case, I feel like if you can do it, it does have real measurable benefits to you. So if you can afford to get a sump and a fuge on your system, if you can retrofit one on, if you're setting up and you're thinking about doing it, I would suggest doing it. But you don't have to, right? In fact, I would say if you don't have a drilled tank, rather than trying to run an overflow box, a siphon box, which I just hate, like you can't believe, I would say, you know what, just ditch the sump altogether. Get an Aquacy Remora, hang it on the back. You can even get one of those, who makes them? The hang-on-back sumps. CPR, I think, makes it. The Aquafuge, yeah. Get one of those. You can even get, I think they make it now, but it's a crappy skimmer on it. CPR makes this Aquafuge with a skimmer built into it, but it's junk, so I would avoid that, get a separate skimmer. But the fact is, if you don't have a drilled tank, you can run a beautiful tank. And I can tell you, there's a guy on our website who everybody is gaga over his corals and how he's able to grow them. And I know for a fact, he runs, what is it, like it's a 29-gallon with an Aqua C on the back, and that's about it. And his tank is spectacular. It's been up for years, and he grows stuff like crazy. I should have asked beforehand to get his permission. I would just tell you who it is, but maybe I'll reach out to him after this, and I'll see if we can just let you know in the show notes or something. So, all in all, sumps and fuges, I think, are a great addition. I think you can run without them just fine, but I think your tank will go better with them. I think the one thing you have to be very careful about when doing this is you want to make sure that when your tank fails, it fails to off. I'm going to repeat that 20 times. We're going to be doing another episode in a little bit on various dosing pumps and systems, and that's going to be a big issue for me there too, because it's something that I worry about with them as well. But basically, it's like this. Make sure if you're running a sump that you have enough free capacity, empty space in that sump, that when you shut the water off, the sump can take up all of the water that's going to drain down from the tank. Now, remember, the water that's going to drain down is maybe 1 or 2 inches, right, until it hits the top of the weir, the top of the overflow that you have on your tank, or if you have a return line and you haven't drilled a siphon break, until the return gets above water. So either way, on my tank, it drains about 5 gallons, 8 gallons out. So my sump just has enough capacity, I can hold 5 or 8 gallons. Therefore, if my return pump fails, or something happens, I don't know what else, and the tank just shuts down, the water's just going to drain down into the sump. I'm not going to have a flood, I'm not going to have an issue. That gets a little bit more difficult if you're running a dedicated refugium, generally just because the water levels in refugiums are higher and you don't always have that excess capacity to play with. But if you're clever about it, right, and you drill your refugium and you sort of plumb the refugium into your sump and the whole thing, you can come up with a strategy that gives you enough excess capacity that you wouldn't have to worry about it. So that's my take on sumps and refugiums. I hope you enjoyed that, and stay tuned for our next segment. Here it comes.
Okay, so it seems like that's going to pretty much cover sumps and refugiums. For the next segment, we're going to discuss quickly, well, actually not quickly, maybe we'll talk about it for a bit, some of the diseases that face your fish and some of the cures that might be available, cures or treatments, or just, you know, whatever you want to call it, just managing the disease. So, let's get started on it. I guess what we're really going to be talking about here are the two main diseases that you're going to face in the hobby, and that's really going to be Marine Velvet and Marine Ick. I mean, there's other stuff, right? If you're getting triggers and you're really buying them, or you're getting some of the bigger fish, you could see flukes come in. They definitely come in sometimes on, like, angels and triggers and things like that. But for the most part, right, if you're buying your fish from a store, they're probably not just going to sell you a fish with a fluke on it. Like, they're going to get it off before they give it to you. So the things you're really going to face are Ick and Velvet. And, you know, I'm not going to talk about... I'm going to talk about this from a hobbyist perspective, right? Because basically, here's how it goes. If the fish has Velvet, it's more often than not, it's dead before you can really do anything about it. It is. Like, you can treat it. I have never been able to. I've had two fish in my whole life that have come in with Velvet. One was a Royal Gramma, and, forget what the other one was. I forget. And I had two that, I'm pretty sure I had two that died of it, and the Royal Gramma, like, you saw a couple spots, and then you're sitting there, and you're thinking, oh, is that Velvet, or is that Ick? I can't really tell, or is it just, like, some grain of sand? And then the next day, the thing is dead with, like, this fuzz over it. That's Velvet. All right? Velvet equals dead fish the next morning. Ick, you can treat, you can even, the fish can live with it for a while. I mean, pretty much, I don't want to say indefinitely, but, look, I got Ick in my tank, and no fish really show it, you know, and sometimes when things get really stressed out, they'll show it, but no fish really show it, at least at this point. And they've had it, it's been in there for years, you know, I mean, it's really been there for years. I had a hippo that used to get it on and off every 8 months, he would get Ick, every 4 months he would get Ick. But then, hold on, this is really professional, I have somebody Skyping me here too. Let me just shut that down. So yeah, you know, and the fish will live with it. As long as they're eating and as long as they're healthy, most fish can survive. There's some fish that are just going to be a lot more sensitive to it than others, right? Tangs are notorious for it. And especially certain tangs, powder blues, you know, powder browns, those guys are really kind of delicate fish to begin with, and they're really susceptible to infection. And then they frequently, when they get infected, unlike other fish that can live with it pretty much indefinitely, they frequently succumb to the infection. So, you know, when you're talking about treating Ick, you've got to look at the fish that you've got. You've got to look at how your fish are actually dealing with it. And then you got to look at what you're going to do to get rid of it. Now, the easiest way that people say to get rid of it is to basically just QT, just to quarantine every new arrival to your tank. And that's certainly right. I mean, flat out, if you don't want it in your tank, the only way to keep it out reliably is to not let it in the first place. So, if you have a quarantine tank set up, or you have an easy way to do it, I would really recommend it. As a practical matter, you can't always quarantine, right? Especially if you're getting a bigger fish. You know, the quarantine tanks I've used in the past have generally been things like an 8-gallon bio cube I used to keep stuck under the stand. What else did I use? Just like a 10-gallon tank, you know, with some crappy little airstone-driven skimmer and a heater and a power head, like thing, or like a hang-on-back, like one of those AquaClear 70 filters. Anything like that, right? As long as you have it sort of up and running, you know, they're a great thing to use. The problem is you can't always stick a bigger fish in there, or there's certain fish that just aren't going to survive a QT, right? At least a long enough QT to really do anything. So, because you really want to be keeping it there a couple weeks and observing it. And if you have a really touchy, finicky fish, you have something like a Potter's Angel or like a Mandarin, though they don't really get Ick that bad. But, you know, if you have a Potter's Angel, a Leopard Wrasse, things like that, things that really are very sort of touchy, very delicate fish, I would suggest generally, and you can go either way on this, but I'd say you're probably more likely to lose the damn thing in quarantine than you are to actually prevent, you know, then you're going to benefit from it. So, and that's clearly not always the case, right? I mean, but that's my take on it. Is if it's a really, really, really touchy fish or a really difficult fish to feed, you know, quarantine tanks are not going to be really nutrient-rich places. They're going to be pretty sterile. They're going to be pretty barren. And it could very easily be a very poor environment for these fish, especially after the stresses of capture and moving and transportation, yada yada. It's not always the best thing. However, that's about 2% of the time. For the other 98% of the time, it certainly is a good thing to do. And I'm sure everybody's going to tell me they're special and that fish is this and that and they can't do it. There's probably about 5 fish I would feel hesitant to quarantine based on behavior, not based on size. On size, it's a different matter. If your fish isn't going to fit into the QT tank, it's not going to fit. But that's the best way to keep it out, really, is quarantining. Okay, once it gets into your tank, which is generally where people start to post on the boards and scream, help, OMG, whatever they say. You know, I have ick, whoop-de-doo. Once it's in your tank, it's a little more difficult, right? Because then you're left with just a bunch of really bad options. You know, one is trying to break down your whole tank and rip all your fish out. Unfortunately, that's the real option. Like, if you really want to get rid of it, and you don't want to be dealing with this for the next however many years you're in the hobby or whatever, you got to get the fish out. You know, you have to. There's no other way. That's just the end of the story, all right? You got to get the fish out. You put them in a quarantine, in a hospital tank, okay? And you treat with copper. Full stop. Okay, I don't care what other advice you've gotten. I don't care what other product that they're insisting will work. Full stop. If you want to get it out of your tank permanently, this is what you got to do. All right. If you don't, and you just want to spend more money, you buy RID-X or RID-ICK or whatever this junk is that they sell, pour it in your tank, hope it doesn't kill your tank and your corals, and then when that doesn't work, you can come back and we'll talk about hospital tanks again. So really, that's it. The only way, once it's in the tank, you've got to get the fish out of the tank. You've got to let that tank sit fallow for really about 3 months. And nothing's going to speed it up, all right? None of this siphoning the sand, running UV, it's not. All right, the things, that those little spores that get everywhere, you just got to wait and let it go fallow. And then, you know, you get whatever it's called, cupramine or one of these copper, cupra safe, whatever they're selling. You know, Seachem or one of these guys has these copper medicines. You add it to the tank at the right dosage. You get your test kits, you make sure it stays at the right dosage, and you keep the fish there till they not just don't show it, because remember, the parasites, they go inside the body and come out. So just because you don't see ick on the fish after you've been putting it in copper for like a week doesn't mean that the fish doesn't have ick. So really, you leave them in there, you do the full run, do the full course of the medication, leave the tank fallow, and, you know, hopefully most of the spores die out. You know, getting cleaner shrimp and things like that can certainly help, especially if you have fish like when I was running my 150 long, I had a nasotang in there that, you know, would constantly have ick, and he would, every time he got it, he'd go over to the cleaner shrimp and he'd rip it off him. Problem solved. But it's not always going to work like that, so there is the one solution, all right? You can get clever, you can come up with excuses to why you're special, why your tank isn't why you found the cure, why your freshwater dip is better than everybody else's, whatever, but from my experience, this is the gold standard, this is the only real way to do it. Okay, so you got the fish out, you've quarantined, you've run your copper in the quarantine tank, you put them in. And then you put your fish back in your tank, and ideally, hopefully, you will then quarantine all new additions and you won't have to go through this again. This all sounds good in theory, but there's a practical thing you've got to consider here, is most people don't just leave a hospital tank, a quarantine tank, up and running all the time. And even if you are leaving it up and running all the time, pretty often its biological filter isn't going to be very strong or very, you know, mature or very well developed, just because you don't, you know, consistently have fish crapping in that water and feeding those bacteria. So you'll see people always claim that QTs and hospital tanks don't work and things like that. And yeah, they're right. Look, if you take your 10 fish that you had in your 150 that's been up for 2 years, and you throw them in a 29-gallon tank with freshly mixed salt water and a hang-on-back filter and a brand new thing of Chemipure, yeah, you're probably going to crash that tank. You will. I mean, the rules for the QT tank are pretty much going to be the same as the rules for your main tank. So there's a couple things you can do to sort of jumpstart it, right? And here are my suggestions for the quick and dirty hospital tank. Right. First is, use the water from your main tank. You know, I mean, that'll help a little bit. It's not going to do a lot. You don't really have a lot of bacteria of the kind that you need, the nitrifying bacteria, denitrifying bacteria, just floating in the water column. But it's a start. So first, use the dirty water from your tank. Second, before you do it, right, because if the fish has ick, you have a couple days, right? It's not like velvet where you're going to wake up and it's dead the next day. It might, but in general, you have time. So don't go rushing things. Don't go acting like an idiot. Get your tank set up. Take some of the filter media that you had in your established tank, right? You don't want to use your rock because you just don't. You don't want to get copper in your rock and all that crap. But take some of the filter media. If you have an old bag of Chemipure, you throw it in there. If you have some old filter floss, use that. Basically, any old filter media that you've been running on your tank for a while, stick into the filter on your new hospital tank, because that will have bacteria on it, and that will help. Also, ramp up on that hospital tank, okay? If you have 8 fish that need to be treated, don't just dump them all in at once, unless, you know, I say that's not really a practical thing, because, right, by the time you're going to catch your fish, you're probably ripping your tank down. So you're going to have to dump them all at once. At least, that's what I would do. So you've got to stay on top of it, all right? Because the truth is, fish do die in QT and in hospital tanks, and they do because the tanks aren't cycled, and because the tanks actually spike in ammonia or whatever, and you already have stressed out fish. Now you have stressed out fish that are already sick in a smaller space with poor water quality. Like you just see where it's going. So when you set up that hospital, that QT tank, it becomes much more of a pain in the ass, which I probably shouldn't say, but pain in the butt, than you would imagine, because not only are you sitting there trying to keep the copper at the right levels, but you're also going to be sitting there doing lots of water changes to really try to keep this water clean, and as you're doing that, you're going to constantly have to be, you know, adding more copper and testing and doing all this junk. But it really is a risk. You know, you got to make really sure you're not going to crash out your tank. I mean, if you're willing to do it, you know, every time I would say take some of your sand, throw it in there or something, and then just throw out the sand, don't put it back in your main tank. But basically, you're going to need to either give that tank time to establish a biological filter, or you're going to have to help that tank fake a biological filter. All right? And you really got to watch it, because it will kill your fish. So, that's really it. I mean, I wish I could give you all these quick and, you know, nifty ways you could get around it, or, you know, tell you that there's some real product. It's almost always, every time you get this question, it's always some Mark Weiss or some junk like that, you know? That there's something you can add, or can I add garlic and ginger, and will that do it? No, the answer is no, right? I mean, the answer is, this is based, as far as I'm concerned, this is the beginning and the end of the discussion. Yes, your fish can live with ick, all right? Whether you want your fish to live with ick is a different question. They can live for quite a while with it, and as long as you keep them healthy, they can live a shockingly long time. I think, you know, you go into the ocean, if you ever go diving, it's pretty rare that you see a fish that doesn't have some sort of parasites or scars or something on it, right? I mean, it's not like they lived in this pristine environment. Like, the ocean's dirty if you're a fish. But, so they can do it. But remember, the rules for the ocean are not the rules for your fish tank, okay? And the ocean is not a 40-gallon breeder with some Caribbean species that you thought was pretty sitting next to a Hawaiian species, sitting next to a fish that is really endemic to the Philippines. Like, it doesn't happen like that. So, the rules are going to be a little bit different. And also, nobody's sitting there dosing copper into the ocean to clear the fish. But, yeah, that's it. I wish there was a quick and dirty fix, but there's not. So, if you got ick, and you don't want to continue to have it, because you will have it indefinitely as long as there are fish in that tank. And that, I promise you, okay? If you can prove me wrong, you can come over to my house. You can take any coral you want out of my tank. You know, go nuts. You can have your pick. But I'm telling you, in my mind, this is it. Either you're willing to live with it, or there's one way to treat it. And if you're not willing to live with it, and you don't really want to have to treat it, there's only one effective way to prevent it from getting into your tank, and that's to quarantine all new arrivals. And unfortunately, I tend to think that means quarantining your corals, too. Because, you know, if it's in the spore stage and it's sitting down on the substrate, you know, those little cysts, those little spores, whatever they're called, they can easily attach to a coral base, and there's no way you can see it. So, I mean, the fact is, I feel like almost any tank, you know, could get it, no matter how careful you are, but that doesn't mean don't be careful, right? And I tend to think that there are, that dips are probably a lot more effective on a coral in preventing parasites from getting into your tank than they are on a fish, just because the parasites aren't going to burrow inside the coral and be working their way out, whereas when you dip a fish, it's probably not even going to get that much off the fish, right? Like, especially if it's ick, where it's inside, and then even then it's sort of like under the fish's scales and under its slime coat for most of the time, you're not really going to get it with a dip. But with corals, I think it's a better chance. So I would dip your coral, I would QT your fish if you don't want it in your tank. If you do, if you don't care, I don't think anybody does, just be safe. You know, I mean, keep the fish well fed, keep your parameters in check, and, yeah, you know, and figure out a way to live with it, or yank all your fish out and let it go fallow. That's it. Sorry. With velvet, I'm not even going to try, because the truth is, in my experience, every time I've actually, like, they just die too quick. So if the fish is velvet, you're screwed. Don't, like, that's it. It's going to die. You know, unless you are really lucky, unless you're one of those reefers who always has a hospital tank up and running, ready to go, ready to take a fish, by the time you finally get your act together and get this thing up and get it stable, your fish will be dead. So, yeah. I mean, I would just pull. If you see a fish and you think it has velvet, I would just yank it from the tank, right? Because it will spread quick, it'll kill quick, and it's, yeah, I would just pull that fish and call it, you know, write it off. And it's a tough call. So, I'm sorry I couldn't give you more, you know, I couldn't give you a product to buy or a quick and dirty solution, but what I've said really will work if you do it. And it's totally up to you how, you know, you want to approach this issue. All right, that pretty much covers this segment on diseases. And I'm going to wrap it up right now and talk about, quickly, some of the different kinds of cleaner shrimp you can put into your tank and whether they really are cleaner shrimp. And we're really just going to, because that's kind of a broad topic, we're going to talk about a shrimp I have in my tank right now that I hate, that I wish I could take out but was a gift, and is a coral banded shrimp, which is technically a cleaner, but not really, and we're going to go into that in the next segment. All right, stay tuned.
All right, so let's continue and keep going with the coral banded shrimp here. Now, the technical name of the fish, the shrimp, is Stenopus hispidus. I have no idea if that's correctly pronounced, but if you have a different interpretation, run with it. They are endemic to the Indo-Pacific. They're used to living at reef temperatures. It's a good thing. Most of the cleaner shrimp are, so that's fine. And they're probably the biggest of the sort of commonly available cleaner shrimp in the aquarium. So, you know, they definitely sort of take up, I don't know if their body is actually the biggest, but when their arms are all stuck out, they definitely take up the most space, and they look kind of the most intimidating. They're pretty bulletproof shrimp. I've only had two of them in the course of the hobby. The longest I had one was, he lived for about 2 years, I guess, and he disappeared with the 90, so, I mean, it had been about 4 years then since I had another one, and I recently was given one as a gift, and it really wasn't a gift, because I couldn't stand that damn thing, and I was thrilled when he finally died the first time. But when I got him again, you know, I couldn't really say no. He went into the tank, whatever. The experience has been, so far, it's been a couple months, it's been totally different. So let's just go into a little bit about this guy and what I think of him. So I think I've never seen a clean. I guess technically in the ocean, they're cleaner shrimp, but in the aquarium, for me, historically, they were just killers of everything else, right? They killed other shrimp, they would kill snails, they would kill crabs. I suspected of killing this little fish that I had, this little clown goby, but I can't prove it. It was a horrid. It would steal food from my corals, it would pick at the corals. It was an awful, awful thing to have in my tank. But, you know, lots of people have them, and clearly they're not causing this much damage for everybody, so maybe that was a unique experience, though I personally know a couple other people who have had equally horrid experiences with these guys. So that's just something to keep in mind. They won't clean. They're going to eat a meaty diet. They're not going to be like algae eaters. They're not going to be great detritus consumers. I think really Nassarius snails are far and away the best for that stuff if you want detritus, and I think, you know, Astrias and Turbos for algae. Like, I would stay away from all the shrimps and crabs for that stuff, but that's a separate point. Ultimately, this guy isn't really going to play a beneficial role in the tank. You know, it certainly won't compare to, say, a blood cleaner or a skunk cleaner shrimp that, you know, most people have, which actually really will you know, you put them in there, you'll see they'll really clean your fish. This guy just won't. He's just not having it. I don't know. I've never, ever seen him do it. I've never heard somebody say that their coral banded was cleaning shrimp, was cleaning other fish. Like, I've just never heard of it. I have heard of him attacking fish. I mean, the thing is, right, like, if you see a cleaner really go after a fish, it almost looks like it's mugging the fish. And when a coral banded goes after a little fish, I think he's trying to kill it. I mean, I think he certainly could kill the fish inadvertently, or at least stress it out to the point that the thing's going to go in the corner and die. So, that was that. That was then, I guess. But now it's been totally different. Now I have a coral banded that's in there with a blood cleaner. They've been together for a while now. There's been absolutely zero aggression or interaction. They're totally on opposite sides of the tank. I even spy on them at night, because that's when I had all the problems last time, was, you know, like, right after lights out, all of a sudden this guy would start going out and foraging and just ripping up stuff in the tank. So I'd be sitting there with, like, a red flashlight spying on my tank at 2 in the morning trying to catch this guy. This time that hasn't really been a problem at all. I mean, he doesn't seem to pick at corals. He doesn't seem to bug fish at all. In fact, he just kind of hides behind a rock and just comes out when the food goes in the water. So he's been pretty harmless. He's also been pretty unseen. You know, my blood shrimp, which isn't the most social of creatures to begin with, I see a ton more than I see the coral banded. So, you know, maybe that will change with time. You know, we'll give it some more time. We'll see if he gets comfortable and comes out. But in general, they are, even my old one too, I remember, was pretty reclusive. And I've heard that putting two of them in together will make them a little more outgoing, and they'll truck around your tank. And the cool thing with these guys is, in fact, it's easy to tell the males from the females. Like, the females have these blue, I don't know if they're ovaries, egg sacs, blue dots kind of back in their shrimpy tail, whatever you call it, and you can see them. I mean, you really can. It's pretty easy to see, and it's pretty cool because there's not a whole lot of inverts where you can easily sex them. This is one of those that you can, you know, just anybody can do it. You don't have to flip the thing over and go looking for anything weird. Like, if you look towards the back and you see these little blue things inside the shrimp, it's a female. If you don't and it's a little bit smaller, it's generally a male. And you buy two of them, you have a male and a female. Boom. You're in business. You put them in the tank. Maybe you'll have better luck. I would be really nervous putting two of them together, two males together, or two females or anything, just because, like, I've seen how bad they can get, and they can be really, really horrible. And it's not going to be the easiest thing to get out of your tank, because unlike a regular cleaner, you know, I stick my hand in the tank now, and every other cleaner I've ever had, the second your hand goes in, that thing jumps up on your fingers and is picking at your cuticles and under your nails and doing all of that. This guy's never done that. I mean, he's just... And the one I had before that never did that. So, there's just something really different about them. And I know they're frequently sold as a cleaner shrimp, but the behavior is... I mean, I would put the behavior much closer to, like, an emerald crab or something, except for it doesn't have any of the algae-eating benefits of an emerald, right? It has all the destructive nature of the emerald and the sort of potential for problems, but without a lot of the upsides. So, look, I'll tell you, even though this one isn't causing a problem right now, I just feel like, you know, you have limited real estate in your tank, and everything that's in there should be, I mean, it shouldn't just be serving a purpose, right? I mean, ultimately the tank is to be enjoyed, but to the extent that you're putting inverts in there that could easily serve a purpose, like, why not do that? You know, it would just make things easier, I feel like. So, you know, in conclusion, I guess, you can get them. I've got one, you know, and he's not, this one at least isn't destroying everything, but there's a lot of potential for problems. I mean, a real lot of potential. I gotta tell you, and this is sort of, you know, folklore, but it's people I know, and I've sort of been doing this for a while, and I've been talking with people, and I've known guys who've had tanks for a while. And more often than not, you hear people saying they hate them and they've had problems with them. So, just take that to heart. If you really want one, you know, get it. It's not gonna kill any, it might kill stuff, but it's not gonna, like, crash your tank, you know? It's gonna be a pain in the ass, and it'll kill things, and eventually you're gonna have to try to catch it if it gets that bad. But if, you know, space is limited, I feel like there's a lot better options out there in either the cleaner shrimp or the sort of, you know, herbivore, detrivore category of critter that you could go with that would serve, you know, a much more useful purpose and have a much greater benefit to your aquarium. So that would be really my take on it. I mean, I hate to just pick on a critter and just bag on it for 10 minutes and say that's it. But this is one of those guys that you see a lot that I wouldn't have thought to do a piece or even to really talk about it unless it had sort of re-entered my life. But when it did, I remembered all the issues I'd had with it, and I figured, you know, it'd be a good thing to share with you guys. So I hope you found it helpful. Hope you found it useful. If you have any questions or if you want to volunteer to try, you know, take my coral banded shrimp and I'll give it to you as a gift, give me an email at aficionado@manhattanreefs.com and we'll take it from there. Alright guys, I think that wraps up this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it, and the next one will be coming out much quicker than this one, I promise. So thank you again for listening, and talk to you soon.